This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Mark Hertzgaard, who has been called one of America's finest reporters by Barbara Ehrenreich. Mark is the author of 6 books, including Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future, and On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. He has covered climate change, politics, and the media for Vanity Fair, The Nation, Time, The New York Times, and many other leading news outlets. Mark Hertzgaard is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Welcome, Mark.
Good to be back.
What led you to write your book, Hot?
I had an epiphanous moment in London when I was there in October 2005. I was doing a piece for Vanity Fair shortly after Hurricane Katrina, and I had been urging the editors to do a piece on global warming, and they'd finally agreed. And I was interviewing in London Sir David King, who was the chief science advisor to the British government. And aside from Al Gore, David King probably had done as much as anyone in the world to awaken public opinion and elite government opinion to the dangers of climate change. I was very interested in interviewing him. And by that time, I had covered climate change for 15 years, so I was a veteran on the beat. But what he told me in our interview absolutely rocked my world. And essentially, to put it in a nutshell, he said that global warming had triggered outright climate change, and it had done so 100 years sooner than scientists had expected. And, you know, I'd spent most of the 1990s traveling around the world to write Earth Odyssey. And all that time, global warming was this future threat, possibility, a terrible thing, but something we could still prevent if we did the right thing. And what David King was telling me was that, no, now climate change is here. And then he dropped the other shoe, which was that once climate change has begun, you can't call it back very quickly because of the inertia of the climate system, simple laws of physics and chemistry. I remember he said, if we shut off all the emissions on the planet of greenhouse gases tonight, which obviously is hypothetical, the temperatures would still go up for another 30 years afterwards. And so after I left his office, I knew I needed some time to sort of clear my head. And he's down by the Parliament. And I walked down Victoria Street past Big Ben, and I was going to walk along the Thames River. And just as I crossed the bridge, people who've been to London will know there's that big Ferris wheel right there called the London Eye. And I heard little kids who were riding on it and going around and shouting and having fun. And their shouts reminded me, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this now, now that I've been a dad longer. I was a new dad then. And they reminded me that I was a dad because my daughter at that point was only 5 months old. And I suddenly said, oh my gosh, Kiara has to live through this, has to live through the fact that we're going to see rising temperatures on this planet now for most of the rest of her life. And I decided right then and there I had to do whatever I could to, A, understand that threat, what did that mean for my little daughter, and B, to try and find some way for her and the rest of her generation to survive that. And so that's how this book began.
What is the Earth likely to be like for your daughter in the future?
Well, it depends a lot on what we do. We know there's a certain minimum of climate change and temperature rise that's now locked in. And what is very important is that we try and keep that to the absolute minimum. And one of the things I do in the book Hot is to describe what that minimum means. There's one point in the book where I kind of assume that, okay, let's say we really get our act together and we kick our fossil fuel addiction quickly, which would say 20 years, which would be a remarkable achievement. That's where the subtitle comes from, living another 50 years. So we know, even in that case, that we're going to lose most of the snowpack in California on the Sierra Nevada mountains, which is the source of a lot of our fresh water, very much the same as up here with you all in the Cascades. Although I will say that the King County government is doing a lot more about it than California is yet. I must say that's the thing that worries me the most about Chiara's particular future is the water. We cannot anymore stop the melting of that snowpack because that's related to the temperature rise, and the temperature rise is going to continue for at least another 50 years. So that's going to mean, I mean, eventually the pack will melt, but in the meantime, there's going to be more water when we don't want it in the winters and less water when we do need it in the summers.
Well, you've just spoken about the future, but you report travels that you took showing that climate change is going on now. Would you like to talk about some of the evidence that climate change is affecting us right now?
Sure. I mean, again, that was the bombshell that David King dropped on me in London there in 2005 was the, because I asked him that very question. I said, so what's the evidence that climate change is actually happening? Because again, you know, this was a major shift, a paradigm shift in our understanding of this problem. You know, this was not supposed to happen for 100 years. In fact, the opening quote of my book is from another British scientist saying, working on climate change used to be about saving future generations. And now, he looked at me and he said, now your daughter's in trouble and you are probably in trouble too. And so what that means is we're going to see a lot more summers like the summer that we had last year on the East Coast, 2010, and that Europe had in 2003. When I asked David King what was his evidence, it was the summer of 2003. It was the worst, hottest summer on record. And at the time, the casualty figures that he gave me were 31,000 people had died in the space of 6 weeks, mainly in Italy, Spain, and France. Later, the European Union revised that study, and I report that in the book for the first time, that 71,000 people died. 71,000 people. In the space of 6 weeks, friends, that is more than we lost during the Vietnam War by far. And that's just from one summer. That was 2003. Here on the West Coast, we were spared from the 2010 heat wave that struck back east. But if you have friends back in New York or Washington or Boston or Philadelphia, you know it was a horrific experience. And again, now we know because of what's locked into the system, that kind of summer heat that we had in 2010 back east, that is going to be no longer record-making. That's going to be normal by the year 2040. You're going to be seeing that every other summer. And that's just one of the examples of the kind of climate change that we're now locked into.
Would you like to speak also about what you observed in Bangladesh in regard to sea level rise?
Yeah. You know, a lot of times people think that sea level rise is this future problem, but it's sure not a future problem in Bangladesh because, as people may know, it's such a flat country. It's basically, the entire country is a delta. 92% of the Himalayan mountain range pours out to the sea through Bangladesh. And because the southern part of Bangladesh is so flat, even a small amount of sea level rise pushes way inland. And I went there for this book and went out to the coast. What you see there is that the farmers, the peasants, who are some of the poorest people on this planet, essentially can't grow rice anymore. I mean, it grows, but it doesn't grow well. Why? Because the soil and the water have too much salt in them, because the sea is pushing farther and farther inland. Now, that's not only because of sea level rise. It's also because India has built a dam farther upriver and has, you know, impeded the flow. But the sea level rise is continuing. It's only been 7 inches so far. And already, instead of 3 to 4 parts of salt per thousand in the soil in southern Bangladesh, that was in 1970, we now see 20 parts per thousand. And that difference has made the yields, the productivity of rice plummet. And what you see, the effects of that, is in the children there. A lot of them are malnourished.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Hertzgaard, author of the book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Overall, how aware are people of the need to adapt to climate change?
Which people? Because it's such a difference. I just was in Washington, D.C. last week, and boy, if you judged by the discussion in Washington, D.C., there's still some question about whether global warming is real. But that is true only inside of the Beltway of Washington, D.C., and largely because the Republican Party has been taken over by the climate zombies, and they are amplified by Fox TV and the others. Around the rest of the world, there is no longer any question in anyone's mind about global warming and climate change. Even the conservative right-wing political parties in Europe, Britain, Germany, France, all those, they run the governments there. None of them question climate science. And indeed, even their policies, what we do about climate change, are way ahead, not just of the Republicans in the U.S., way ahead of the Democrats, much more ambitious. Now, that is referring to the first half of the problem, which is turning off the heat. Your question was specifically about adaptation, which I call the second half of the problem, which is dealing with the amount of climate change that's already locked in. And that means improving the sea defenses to storms and sea level rise and preparing for those kinds of heat waves that we were discussing earlier. And in that regard, even Europe is still behind the curve of where they need to be, with some exceptions. Britain and the Netherlands, very, very well-articulated programs. The Netherlands are spending over $1 billion a year to prepare, but that's an exception.
Would you say more about what governments are trying to do to adapt?
Well, let's talk about the King County government, because you guys happen to have one of the real success stories, and I would say that on a global level. Ron Sims, who, of course, was your county executive here for many years, and now is the number two official in the Obama administration's Department of Housing and Urban Development, he really, I describe him in the book as one of the most far-sighted leaders on climate change in the world, not just in the country, in the world. And what made him that, in my estimation, is that he gets this new double imperative of climate policy. It's no longer enough just to turn off global warming by reducing the emissions, although, golly, we've got to do that more urgently than ever. But now we've also got to figure out how to cope with the impacts that are locked in. So in a phrase, what the experts say about this is we need to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. Avoid unmanageable global warming by cutting the emissions and manage the unavoidable by putting in place better sea defenses, or what Sims championed here, an extraordinary story down there in the Green River area to the south near your airport, improving the levees there, increasing taxes to upgrade the levees there, and getting reelected despite that. That is impressive. And the way he did that was to explain to the people and bring the public into the planning and make them realize if we have a levee breach here, which is going to become more likely with climate change, it would cost this region $46 million a day, because a lot of Seattle's warehouses and I believe all the Starbucks equipment and food deliveries, you would lose $46 million a day. And so the businesses down there said, okay, yeah, I guess we better improve the levees. So they did that. The Westbridge housing development, it's low-income housing that is resilient to climate change. I really just can't say enough about what King County has done. Are they perfect? No. But they are working the problem. They are making progress. They've got it on the agenda. Sims has, I think, drilled into the county government here to, quote, as he puts it, ask the climate question, which means find out from the scientists what kind of climatic conditions we're going to be facing in the year 2050, and then work backwards from there to, okay, how do we prepare for 3 feet of sea level rise? How do we prepare for both less water in the summer and more water in the winter? And people could do a lot worse than study what King County has done.
What is going on in the rest of the U.S.? How does the rest of the U.S. compare to King County?
I hope the rest of the U.S. will follow King County's lead. And there are places that are, Chicago and New York City, oddly enough. They're quite candid about literally studying the playbook that was written here in King County. So I see some heartening work there. And in California, we have a state climate adaptation plan. And now that Jerry Brown's been elected governor, I assume that will continue, although it began under Schwarzenegger. And Schwarzenegger was a big champion of it. So there are some places that are doing the right thing, but very few. And in particular in the South, Florida, very, very behind the curve.
Well, in a sense, you've alluded to this earlier, but in your book, you speak about rich countries being more susceptible to climate change than they think. Would you explain?
I thought that was so interesting, because the common assumption has always been, look, it's going to be the poor who are going to get hit by this, and they will get hit by this. But we in the rich countries, we have the technology, we have the money, we can deal with this, which is, in fact, that was what the fossil fuel companies and the opponents of climate action used to say in the 1990s. We don't have to worry about this. The science isn't right. And even if the science turns out to be right, we can always spend our way out of the problem. Not so. And the most compelling evidence for that, in my mind, came from the Dutch, who said, if we can give the rest of the world one piece of advice about adapting to climate change, start now. You have farther to go than you think. And they say that on the basis of their own history, because most of what you need to do involves real political negotiating. You know, they protected their country, and it took them 50 years after the terrible floods of 1953. And they said, you know, building the actual sea defenses, that took 10 years. It was the politics and the legality of it all that takes a long time. You know, you've got to be able to, in many cases, private property rights have to be challenged. And that is sacrosanct, especially in the South. You know, in Louisiana, there was no building code until Hurricane Katrina. So in a society that looks at any kind of planning as a form of socialism and taxes as theft, which is the case in so much of the United States, especially among the Republican Party, they are going to be very unable, I think, to adapt. And rich people have one other disadvantage compared to poor people. Poor people are simply tougher. They're more resilient. You know, they are used to not having electricity. They are used to their lives not being under their control and bouncing back. Look at us. If we lost electricity, if we lost our cell phones for 2 hours, we don't know what to do. What happens when the electricity goes out and we can't get cash out of the cash machines? This society is much more fragile and vulnerable than we think.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mark Hertzgaard, author of the book Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Would you like to speak now about some of the efforts in the developing world to adapt to climate change?
I sure would, because I know how easy it is for this conversation to go kind of gloomy places. And the single most hopeful story I came across in the 4 years of working on this book was in the developing world, specifically in West Africa, where illiterate farmers, some of the poorest people on earth, were doing really ingenious things and successful things to adapt to climate change. And what's interesting is that most of those farmers don't even know the term climate change. They know the reality, for sure. But what they're doing is growing trees amid their fields of sorghum and millet. I realize I'm saying growing trees, not planting them. They are growing those trees. They're too poor to plant. They don't have the money to buy seedlings, and they don't have the reliable water supply to keep them alive. What they do instead is they allow the trees that sprout in their fields to grow instead of cutting them down. And that turns out to be remarkably effective. And they combine that technique with another technique that is sort of very, very old indigenous knowledge. They cut something called a zai, which is like a little tiny little pit or hollow that essentially is just to hold water in the ground. And they will put a little bit of manure in there, and that manure oftentimes holds seeds that the animals have eaten, and the trees, or we might even call them shrubs, sprout up. Now, of course, in most parts of the world, farmers cut that out, but there in West Africa, those farmers have stopped doing that, have let them grow, and the results have just been incredible. Because what that does, the trees provide shade, so automatically you are reducing the temperature that the millet and the sorghum have to grow, which is a good thing. Second, the tree's roots go down into the earth and they ventilate and aerate the soil so that when water does come in the form of rainfall, it doesn't just rush off into the streams and rivers. It soaks into the ground. Then the leaves that fall off from the trees provide more mulch and fertilizer. I write about a guy who's been there, a Dutch professor of geography who's been working there for 30 years. And we have seen just the most remarkable results. Productivity of the food is doubling and tripling. Underground water tables are rising as much as 15 meters, call it 50 feet. This is very hard to believe, I must say. I would not have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. And, of course, the most heartening aspect of this is that the malnutrition of children has been cut way down in those parts. Now, the countries we're talking about here, Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, obviously, there's still a lot of hunger there, but not in the places where they're doing this so-called regreening. And the regreening, the other beautiful thing about it is it's not funded by the outside world. This is passing from one farmer to the other, one village to the next, organically, if you will, at the grassroots level. And it's now spread so widely that you can literally see it from outer space. U.S. government satellite pictures, you can now see the border between Niger and Nigeria. And in Niger, they practice this regreening. In Nigeria, they do not. So if those kinds of people with no formal education and really no money can do all that to cope with climate change, I think it just shows how much those of us who have other advantages can and should be doing, not only for our own part, but to help those people.
What do you see as the relative importance of efforts such as the one you just described and efforts at the level of national governments?
I think that you obviously need both. I'm most heartened by those kinds of grassroots efforts, but there is no substitute for government. Only a government can build seawalls. Only a government can run a public health system. Only a government can write and enforce building codes. That's going to be a big issue, especially in the Caribbean and the Gulf region, because we're going to be seeing much stronger hurricanes. And you absolutely have to have building codes that are going to create buildings that can survive that. So I would never want to be thought to be arguing against government action. That's going to be one of the keys. In fact, what I learned, at least in doing the research for this book, is that it's not just money and technology. What really matters in coping with climate change is what I call the social context. Do you have a functioning government? Do you have a cohesive society and a community where people work together, where people are willing to pay taxes, where people feel like their taxes are well spent? All of those things turn out to be very important.
To what extent are wealthy developed countries currently assisting developing countries in adapting to climate change?
Very good question. We don't know the answer to that entirely. There are some useful individual initiatives. And the big statement that you'd have to make is that at least now, after the Cancun Climate Conference a couple months ago, the rich countries are formally committed to helping poor countries adapt. That was probably the single most important decision made at Cancun, which was for the rich countries now, they have formally agreed, officially affirmed that they have an obligation, beginning immediately, to provide billions of dollars a year to poor nations. And of course, the argument there is that not only that the poor nations are the most vulnerable to climate change, but that the poor nations did not cause this problem. It's obviously the industrial nations whose emissions cause this, and so they have to pay. And to their credit, the rich nations have finally accepted that moral and legal imperative. And they have agreed to begin providing $10 billion a year for the next 3 years, ratcheting up to $100 billion a year by the year 2020. That is almost certainly not going to be enough, but it is a start. But it is a start only on paper, because so far, when reporters look into this, we find that most of that money has either not arrived or it is just a reshuffling of existing commitments. So, say, Germany, or more likely the United States and Britain, we'll say to a country like Bangladesh, okay, we're already giving you $100 million, so we're going to just shift that over. Instead of giving it to your public health system or your roads or what have you, we're going to give it to climate change. And the poor countries say, wait, that's not what we're talking about here. That is robbing Peter to pay Paul. And so I think that we need continued pressure on this front to make sure that the rich countries do the right thing. We're the ones who caused this problem, not intentionally. We didn't know, my parents did not know when my dad used to drive a Cadillac in the 1960s that he was, you know, creating a climate catastrophe for his unborn granddaughter. But it doesn't matter in legal terms. It doesn't matter whether you intended to burn down your neighbor's house. If you did, even by accident, you have to pay for it.
Based on the research you did for your book, how much effort do you think should be given to adapting to climate change compared to making efforts to prevent it in the first place?
I think what has to happen now is that those two imperatives have to be melded. It's no longer enough to do one or the other. You have to do both, and you have to do both in a way that each complements the other rather than diminishing it. So, for example, a very good example of this is air conditioning. You know, that we know for a fact that the temperatures, especially in summer, are going to be going up in the years to come. And the obvious answer to that is air conditioning. And air conditioning, in that sense, is a form of adaptation. in France, for example, after that deadly 2003 heat wave, the French government invested in their public health system, but also in something called cooling centers, which would be in every community. There would be a center where especially older people could go, and it would be air conditioned, and they could cool their bodies down. Well, that's useful as an adaptation measure, but if that air conditioning is created by electricity produced from fossil fuels, you're making the climate change problem worse at the same time that you're confronting it. So if you're going to be doing air conditioning, from now on, we've got to make sure that the air conditioning is coming from solar or wind or green energy sources. So that's a negative example. One of the most positive examples of how you can do both adaptation and mitigation at the same time is trees. Grow trees, plant trees. That's another beautiful part of that West African story. You know, not that they should be worrying about reducing the world's emissions, but they are, in effect, helping to cool down the planet because, of course, trees and plants take in CO2. And in cities, and again, here in King County, one of the great things that you guys are doing is keeping trees in the ground. Deforestation is about the worst thing you can do for climate change, against the fight for climate protection. And growing and planting trees is about the best thing that you can do.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Hope. Hope. We have to have hope, and we have to never give up. I mean, we started this conversation. I wrote this book because of my own little daughter, who's now 5. And I understand that this is a very difficult message often to hear, and it often looks very gloomy. I call her and her generation Generation Hot because they are locked in now to the hottest climate in our civilization's history. But what I came out of this book knowing and being encouraged by is that there are so many solutions to this. There are so many ways, not only that we can reduce the emissions, but that we can cope with what lies in store. We know what to do, friends. It is just a question of going out and doing it and making our governments do it. And that means politics must be committed. You may think you don't care about politics. It cares about you. Get out there. None of us can save the planet by ourselves, but together we can.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Mark.
My pleasure.
You have just been listening to Mark Hertzgaard, author of the book Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, published in 2011 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. For more information, check on the web at markhertzgaard.com. Again, that's MarkHertzgaard.com. You can also check on the Facebook page for Generation Hot. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.